Welcome to Stories of Safety. In this podcast series, we will talk to the people who have shaped healthcare safety. We will explore the stories, science, and policy that have shaped how we think about, manage, and measure the safety of healthcare. This series is funded by the National Institute for Healthcare Research and brought to you by the Patient Safety Research Collaboration in Yorkshire and Humber. I'm Jane O'Hara. I've been a patient safety researcher for over 15 years. In this time, I have come to understand how complex healthcare is and how difficult it can be to answer one seemingly simple question. How safe are we and how can we improve? In this series, we will be exploring this deceptively simple question from all angles with people who have helped shape healthcare safety in the UK and across the world. In this episode, we are talking about healthcare harm. It might seem like this is something that we talk about all the time in healthcare. However, today we are going to be thinking more deeply about the concept of healthcare harm, what it is, why it continues to be an important topic in patient safety, and how healthcare services might improve how they respond to harm events. To do this, I'm delighted to be joined by one of the world-leading experts on this concept, Dr. Jo Whaling. Say hello, Jo.
Hi, Jane. I can't use that title yet because I haven't got my official
letter. Oh, come on. Yes, you can.
But I do appreciate your calling me that for the first time on your podcast. Thank you.
Well, and by the time this goes out, you may well be officially able to use that. So just a bit of background on you, Jo. Jo is a registered nurse who has been working for over 30 years within health and disability settings. Alongside a successful recent defence of her PhD thesis, Jo co-designed, delivers, teaches, and evaluates complex restorative and healthcare safety programs. Jo is based in New Zealand, but collaborates with an extended global network of academics, government agencies, patient advocates, and advocacy organizations, as well as healthcare professional groups, to build capability and capacity in these areas. Additionally, Jo is co-chair of the National Collaborative for Restorative Initiatives in Health. Put simply, Jo is one of the leading experts globally on how to build capacity for and undertake restorative responses to healthcare harm. And we are delighted to have you here with us today, Jo. Thank you so much for joining us. Okay, so at the beginning of these podcasts, what I like to do is to start with a bit of a sense of place. So where were you born?
Oh, thanks, Jane. That's a great question to start a conversation about restorative initiatives, because we're always thinking about who we're connected to and the places that we're from and our genealogy associated with that. So I'm originally from Birmingham in the United Kingdom, was where I was born back sometime in the 70s. And then I grew up in and around Brighton in Sussex, which is a really cool, diverse city. And my last role was matron of the emergency department there before I moved to Aotearoa, New Zealand, 12 years ago.
So I'd like to dig out an interesting fact about where people are from, or some sort of interesting fact about them. I did Google at the beginning where the surname Whaling originated from, but there was nothing out there. Nothing out there on that. So I got an interesting fact about Solihull, and apparently it got its name because it was a hill next to Birmingham where they dumped their soil and was called Solihull Hill. And people from Solihull Hill are known as Silhillians. So there you go.
Ah, and now it's the posh bit on the side of Birmingham.
And now it's the posh bit, indeed. Absolutely. So you've talked a little bit already about being a nurse. You were originally trained as a nurse. What did you specialise in?
So most of my career I spent in intensive care and critical care outreach. I worked in Brighton, Leeds and London. And then I moved to running the emergency department in Brighton, which is a major trauma centre. And that was really interesting and also very challenging. And that's where I first got interested in thinking about safety and safety research and factors. And that's where I had my first exposure to training and human factors, and with the lovely Rob Galloway, which really sort of shaped my thinking. And then when I moved to New Zealand, I carried that through into roles that have included national safety roles and associate director of nursing roles over here.
So you kind of answered a little bit my next question, but can you talk to us a little bit more about why you started getting interested in patient safety research. What were you seeing in your work that sparked that interest for you?
What really drove the interest for me was that I felt that there were lots of different views and perspectives on what safety looked like, that the ways in which we were measuring and sort of managing safety didn't seem to be really working. And I was curious about why that might be. And then really I got interested in extending from that, thinking about the ways in which we respond and how they impact people that are involved in those processes, and also really how effective or not those processes might be in terms of making improvements, particularly given that I got a qualification in human factors around the same time. So really just thinking about those multiple perspectives of safety, that embedded ways of thinking about safety weren't really sort of aligned with that or open to those different ideas about how an event occurs and the experience of it.
You very nicely led me into the bit I want to talk about next, which is healthcare harm as a concept. So our listeners to this podcast might think this is self-evident. You know, what is healthcare harm? Everybody will know what healthcare harm is. But I'm interested, particularly on the basis of what you just said, in what your take is. You know, what do you think of when you think about healthcare harm? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, well, I have experienced harm myself and I've observed it greatly in my career, both in terms of patients being affected by inequitable access to care that they require, also thinking about harm that emerges from what you and I would term adverse events or incidents. So when patients are harmed during the provision of healthcare, there's also harm that occurs to health professionals in the environments in which we're working within that aren't appropriately resourced, or the conditions are forcing us to make decisions that maybe would not be aligned with best practice because of resourcing issues or because of complexity or demand at the time. So there's lots of contributing factors that lead to what we call harm, but there's different perspectives of harm and what it means. There's this idea that we can prevent harm if we only intervene in ways in which we control the system and we put controls in place to stop people from doing what might be considered to be not the right way of doing things. There's ideas around harm being intentional. So that's that idea that we, as clinicians or other healthcare workers, that you know, individuals are reckless or they break the rules, when in actual fact, most of the time, we're kind of working around those conditions I described earlier, which can be quite difficult and emergent. And then there's these ideas that we can learn from harm. So when something goes wrong, it provides an opportunity for us to be able to learn from it and improve it and improve our systems so that we can mitigate the risk of harm happening again. And all of those things are quite well embedded and studied. But what I'm particularly interested in is the human experience of harm. So this idea that when we're involved in an event during the course of our treatment, whether that be conflict or an adverse event or a complaint, that actually provokes a human experience, an emotional experience, and how the procedures that follow through from that can actually affect people.
Now, that was a great answer, Jo. Thank you. And kind of thinking that's a very expansive view of harm, in a sense. And how does that differ, do you think, then from what healthcare policy or healthcare organisations might think of as harm? And is that a problem?
I think there's two parts to that question, aren't there? One is, how do institutions respond? And the other would be, how do the ways in which institutions respond actually impact people, and do they have the outcomes that one would hope? So I'm interested in how institutions respond to harm. So the ways in which institutions would usually respond is to work in a way where they take ownership of the harm. And by that, I mean, they have policies and procedures that come into play. They're predefined frameworks that dictate how people will move through a process, what the outcomes are that they want to expect, and what they're often focused on, the outcomes that institutions and professions privilege. So those might be quite risk-based in terms of keeping people apart because there might be legal considerations. They might be focused on a legal framework, or they might be focused on like a safety framework in which they're wanting to find ways to learn from what's happened and improve the system. So one of the challenges with that is the people who are most directly affected by the harm don't necessarily have the opportunity to say how they would like the harm to be addressed, how the harm has affected them, or what they think would be effective recommendations for how they want harm mitigation to occur. So a fundamental premise for restorative responses, which is, as you know, the area that I'm predominantly interested in, is based in this idea by Niels Christie, which is that when conflict, he wrote about conflict as property, but in this sense, it would be harm, becomes the property of an institution, that actually then the institution or the profession can use their procedures and practices to their advantage. And they don't necessarily do this consciously, but in healthcare after adverse events, the way that that plays out is that the institution will privilege learning and improvement and often reputational risk over the human experience and impacts of patients and families. And what that actually leads to is these sort of structural relational violations that people experience that can be deeply compounding of the harm and can contribute to mental distress and trauma and even suicidal ideation. So even though they're well-intentioned, and if you talk to institutional leaders about this, they would be absolutely horrified to think that their processes and policies would in any way be intended to do anything other than good. Unfortunately, we know from the evidence, from my research and indeed yours, Jane, that this is actually the reality of the experience of patients and families and also clinicians as well.
In a paper that actually you and I published in 2022, we discussed this concept of compounded harm, and you've mentioned that in your previous answer. Could you explain to our listeners what compounded harm means and why it is important?
That's a massive question.
I'd like to throw these enormous questions at you.
So compounded harm is obviously an undesirable outcome. So that's when the experience of the harm, the actual initial event itself, is made worse by the way that we respond. So when we're talking about responding, we're talking about the ways that we respond in interpersonal interactions and the ways that we respond in institutional policy as well. So a response includes both of those things. So we're not just talking about institutions, because institutions are made up of people, and the quality of the relationships that we have with people can mitigate or amplify or contribute to compounded harm. So when those institutional kind of responses or our interpersonal interactions are characterized by owning the harm and the process that responds without taking responsibility for the impacts and the actions for repair, that's one way in which compounded harm is generated for both staff and for patients and families. And that often happens when we offer people responses that don't meet their needs or don't respond to their needs. And people have a range of justice needs when they're involved in an adverse event. And they tend to be characterized, what we like to characterize them, in a framework which is easier to make sense of. So one is around substantive needs. So that's, what do I need right now? Or what do I need to substantively address this? And that might be things like compensation, or it might be simple things like, how am I going to care for my children because my husband's just died? And how can I get support with that? And those needs are going to shift and change throughout the course of the investigation. Then we have procedural needs. So those kind of needs are things like, who do I want to talk to? How do I want to share my experience or not? Do I even want to be involved in this adverse events process? And what does that look like? And how will that be like? And what support can I access throughout the process in order to ensure that I feel safe culturally, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, etc. If those needs aren't understood and responded to, we can inadvertently also compound the harm. And when we compound harm, we provoke these violations that tend to fall into five categories. So we can violate people's dignity. So that's when we act in a way that actually invalidates someone's lived experience of an event. And that doesn't mean that we all have to agree on what happened, but we do need to validate that somebody's memory or recollection of it is correct, and how they feel about it is correct. So often professional institutional responses will say, no, that couldn't possibly have happened because we have a policy that says X, or, you know, I would never behave like that towards you in a professional capacity. But you know, if that was their experience of a process or an interpersonal interaction, then we're violating their dignity by not validating it. Other violations would be around the consent. So that's when we ask people to step into an adverse event process or a complaint process without fully informing them of what that's actually going to mean and how that's going to impact them. Not just thinking about legal rights, but thinking about the emotional and psychological impacts and actually what is the reality of that process. And often people go through several different processes. So after a suicide, for example, you would have a coroner's process, adverse events process. You might have other regulators involved. And each of those processes has a different aim and a different response and different levels of support. So we're actually often asking people to step into several different processes without actually informing them about what that means. And that can be really violating. Other ways that we can contribute to compounded harm include violations around identity. That's when we act in ways that prevent people from being able to make sense of what's happened to them within a relationship. And that might be because we ascribe them a certain identity within the process. So that might be, you know, this is a really bad clinician, this is a reckless clinician. And then we keep them apart from the people that they want to connect with and to share the story with, to help them make sense of the experience. It might be somebody who is a mother who's lost a child, their identity is being violated because we're seeing them as being hysterical or an angry person that won't go away and won't just listen and understand that we have found out what's objectively happened in this event, and now they're just being overly emotional about it. We're actually violating their identity when we work with them in that way. And then we can also violate care by not thinking about the different supports that people might need, or we can violate responsibility when we don't then take all of this information that we've gathered and actually act in ways that are meaningful and make a difference for future safety of other patients, but also of the people that have been affected. Because some of the things that they might want us to take responsibility for are nothing to do with system improvement.
Incredibly interesting. And I think it really helps sometimes to lay these things out. And, you know, even at a most basic level, what you've described and what I've seen in some of my work is just the sheer number of processes and people that somebody that is on the, that has experienced a healthcare harm event might encounter or might have to navigate through in the course of being responded to by an organisation or by a suite of organisations. So as you say, and I think particularly in mental health, that's very problematic when somebody has died by suicide and there were all these kind of different processes that happen in tandem, or rather in parallel rather than in tandem, with different aims. And but sort of experiential journey through that must, and you know, people have talked to me about that, is just overwhelming and it's not joined up necessarily. And I think that that continues to be a sort of societal level source of compounded harm, where you kind of wonder, you know, how are we helping people through those processes? If they're serving sort of, you know, societal level accountability purposes, that's great. If they're serving some sort of accountability purposes for the patient or the family, that's great. But collectively, what are we doing to people, you know, through the course of those processes when we don't support them through that, I think is something that I've been very struck by. And all of those violations that you've just described, I think, so beautifully outline the multitude of ways, when we really think about it, that our systems, it's more a miracle that somebody won't have their harm compounded going through all of that stuff in some way.
I think epistemic injustice is really important concept that lies at the heart of people's experiences of compounded harm when they're going into all these different processes. And within those processes, they're not often enabled to be able to determine who they want to tell their story to, how they want to tell their story, who they wanted to be involved in it. They're underpinned by quite adversarial principles that keep people apart. Right. They prevent opportunities from us coming together in relational ways, being able to express our moral anger, be able to achieve some kind of moral balance that we can only really get to through the mutuality of a dignified relationship. And they are serving our legal systems. They're serving like the ways in which society is designed to be able to deal with harm or acts that are seen to be, you know, potentially reckless under the law or negligent, but they often take away the power or the opportunity for people to be able to decide those things for themselves. And we know that when people are experiencing particularly sudden death in adverse events, that particularly suicide, it's a very violent experience being involved in the death of a loved one or a death by suicide. And there's often a lot of blame and shame and self-doubt that is experienced by families and also the clinicians who are caring for those individuals. And if we're not able to find ways in which that we can express that shame and that guilt and that moral anger that we feel, then people's harm can be and trauma can, and mental distress can be extended. And we know from certainly from our research here that that can result in suicidal ideation itself. So we're starting to realize that adverse events are potentially traumatizing experiences, and actually really thinking about the ways that we mitigate compounded harm is important as a public health issue, as well as as a way to improve our systems and learn from them. And there's a huge responsibility there.
And whose responsibility is that? I think that's exactly one of the key questions. But I think what you're saying is, you know, these events drop like stones into a river, and they have this extraordinary, you know, ripple effects that span not just the individual, but all kinds of people for all kinds of ways. And interestingly, when I was doing some of our work on mental health, some of the most emotional interviews I've had is with staff on whose watch, if you like, people have died by suicide, and processes that follow for them professionally and through their organisation can be incredibly impactful on them. So, you know, when you start to sort of map out those ripple effects, it's hard not to see these things as sort of public health interventions in a sense, because so many people are affected by the way that we respond. And it's what I always say, you know, we might not be able in a complex healthcare system to eradicate events entirely, but what we can do is respond to them in ways that make those events worse, the harm associated with those events worse.
Suicide's a really good example of how an event affects a community. Most adverse events in mental health settings are suicides. We know that for each person who dies by suicide, I think there's around 141, I think it is, people who are affected from the research, or something around that. And the extent to which people are affected and the impact is not necessarily related to their relationship or their closeness to the individual who's died. So when we think about it that way and we extrapolate out from that, it means that we need to have a community response. Whereas when we think about adverse events normally, we tend to think about them as having two individuals, the patient who's affected and the clinician who is involved in their care. When in actual fact, in reality, there probably is the similar number of people who are affected, particularly after a death. And again, it shows the complexity of the response, the number of people who are involved, and how we need to be really mindful their experience of the harm might not necessarily be, you know, related to their closeness to the individual who's died as well. The fact that mental health clinicians understand this actually is probably why restorative responses are finding legs within mental health in particular, because they understand the need for a community response. They understand the importance of human relationships and being a protective factor against harm, but also in terms of healing basic trust from trauma. And also they understand the importance of relational ways of working, and that those can be principles based and not necessarily having to be about having a dialogical face-to-face interaction.
So I think we've laid out the scale of the problem and why conceptually we probably need to think differently about what healthcare harm means and also how it's created. And so what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about where we go from here. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on this podcast to talk to us is because you've been part of probably the most famously, on a global stage, the most famous and most potentially most impactful systemic piece of work where you've tried to take a community of harm patients and work through using restorative responses at a sort of system level. So in June 2019, the Ministry of Health in New Zealand instigated a restorative justice approach to exploring the harm caused by surgical mesh. How did you come to be involved in that process?
I was interested in restorative responses based on my use of them, circle practices, to address bullying in a emergency department. And I was really amazed at how effective it was. So when you sit in a restorative circle, which is what we used, you ask what happened, how it's affected people, and what they need to move forward, how they would like to be supported to do that. So I was really impressed by how effective that was. I was just finishing my master's, which was around different perspectives of safety, and I ended up writing this PhD proposal about using restorative responses to patient harm and adverse events. And the reason I was interested in that was because I felt that there might be some potential in terms of relational ways of responding to patient harm. And then around that time, I met Professor Chris Marshall, who was the academic supervisor for the project and the chief medical officer for New Zealand at different events. And I suggested that a restorative approach might be of use because the ministry at that time had already done a survey and of harm consumers. We use the term consumer in New Zealand because it has particular meaning under the law. So that means patients, families as well. So we had this survey, which had revealed that people wanted to tell their story in different ways to different people. And I analysed that for the ministry and within a restorative framework. And that initial survey actually showed that there were a range of needs involved, both physical needs and psychological needs, that there was already a degree of harm from the way that the government had responded over a number of years. And we felt that a restorative approach would be appropriate in order to listen and understand what mesh-injured New Zealanders wanted, to be able to plan and act for the future. And then also really that because we were using a novel approach in the complex health environment, we also suggested evaluating and building evaluation in from the beginning all the way through. So that's how I got involved in the project. And the research kind of piece of it, first of all, looked at Like, what data do we actually need to be able to design a restorative approach to surgical mesh harm that is based on the evidence from restorative field, and also what mesh injured or mesh harm New Zealanders want to get from this process. And we co-design that with the Office of the Chief Clinical Officers and the consumer advocacy group Mesh Down Under. And then the second piece of it looked at evaluating what worked and how people experienced the restorative response. And then the third piece, which is my PhD, looked at a realist evaluation. And that was really understanding like what worked for whom and in what context or in what conditions.
You've talked a little bit about what the programme involved there. So but you've also talked about circles and how you came into this really affected by the experience of using circles demonstrably within clinical settings in particular. And you were potentially then moving that out to say, can we actually bring small groups of people together who coalesce around this harm, essentially, I guess. When I've spoken to you about it in the past, you know, as I understand it, you brought together essentially surgeons, other clinical people involved, and women, patients who had received surgical mesh as part of their treatment. So who was involved in those circles and how did you do that? Because I remember the first time in 2019 when we discussed this and I just thought that's an incredible job just to bring that group of people together.
The first thing I would say is that the surgical mesh project itself, when we think about it in terms of what restorative practices it involved, the first piece was around co-design, and that was around exploring and building the relationship proactively, first of all, with the members of the co-design team, which was the ministry and Mesh Down Under. It was very clear that there was a degree of nested conflict. So this is the idea that conflict that occurs between individuals based on and is influenced by other factors like the institutional kind of policies and response, but also the other things that sit around institutions like the ways in which mesh was introduced, who was making decisions around those. So things that actually these individuals in conflict had no control over. So there was this nested conflict and it was very deeply ingrained and the character of the relationship was actually very adversarial on both sides. It was described as David and Goliath, and there's descriptions in the data around sort of bullying and violence and things like that. So before you can even start to design any kind of response, when you have those kind of conditions, and you'll have met those when you're doing your research and you can see them evident in inquiries into maternity in the UK at the moment, that kind of nested conflict and the conditions that sit around that. Before you can move into a design space, you actually have to build relationship. So we used circles in the co-design process to, first of all, agree the values and principles that were going to guide the project and the ways in which we were going to work. And when there were bumps in the road, which there always are, we revisited those guidelines and those values in order to keep us on track. So that was a really important first step of how we used a circle process. So when you sit in a circle, there is a question asked by the facilitator and everyone answers the question. We sit in a circle, which equalizes power relationships. Sometimes we use a talking piece, which embodies restorative values like equity, so sharing the time fairly, respect, and there were also agreements around confidentiality. And that was really important because you're dealing with highly sensitive information between government officials and harm patients and families, and agreeing comms that are going to go out. So you have to make sure that those things are all supported. So that's one way in which we use circles in the co-design process. Another way that we use circles was to listen to the stories of or experiences of mesh injured New Zealanders. So within those circle processes, we would have about 8 to 10 New Zealanders affected or harmed by mesh, members of what we called the responsible party. So those were representatives of institutions who had a part to play in either responding to mesh harm or a role to play in how it was implemented and utilised in the first place. And that included representatives of the colleges, of No Fault, No Blame legislation organisation, and various other parties. In those circles, we asked people very simple, broad questions. What is it you want us to know and understand about your experience of surgical mesh, and what is it that you need to know now to move forward? Those were the two key questions. And we also had a round at the beginning that connected people as human beings and was very clear about the ground rules for the session, and a question at the end about a strength that people had observed in themselves or others. Now, you might think, if you're listening to this and you're a safety investigator, how could I possibly get information that is important for safety out of such broad questions? Well, we did a thematic analysis of those, and we actually ended up with very similar recommendations to other mesh inquiries from around the world that have implemented a more traditional approach to inquiry. But what we found through our research is that being in those circles, listening to those stories, was actually deeply motivating for those representatives of responsible parties. It was described afterwards as creating the conditions for action and collaboration in ways that hadn't been seen before. And we're actually going pretty good guns on a lot of those recommendations that were made. But I just want to make clear that restorative isn't just about circles. Being relational doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have a face-to-face meeting or a dialogical kind of encounter. Restorative practice continuum goes from effective questions and conversations that respect the agency and dignity of others through to these kind of listening circles and restorative meetings. But you can also be relational or restorative in different ways, as long as you're applying those principles of respect, of equity, of trustworthiness, of voluntariness. So we also had a story database. And what really amazed me was how many people used that to tell their stories in different ways, through video, through poetry, through artwork, as well as through written word as well. And again, I think this is testament to this idea of creating the conditions for and opportunities for epistemic justice. And so ways in which people can tell their stories in ways that matter to them and be heard by the people that they want to be heard by, and be seen by the people they want to be witnessed by as well through that process.
So what I think you are saying here is a couple of things which I think are really important for our listeners here, that restorative practice runs on a continuum. And that actually all of us can take steps to start. You know, it's not a dichotomous variable. You're not either doing restorative work or you're not. And so we shouldn't be put off by or overwhelmed by the sort of some of the bigger structural changes that we might need to make in our systems to incorporate some of these more ambitious ways of working. That actually we can go and start to work more relationally, as you say. And I think one of the things that working with you and with harm patients has shown me is we've tried to incorporate this in some of the materials that we've developed based on these principles, as you know, is actually one of the most simple things that you can do with harm, people who've experienced harm, is actually just listen to them without prejudice in the beginning. And it sounds so ridiculous when you're saying it out loud because it's so obvious. It's what you would do with your friend or your family member. You would sit and listen. And I think what we've done for so long in patient safety is just to leap to processes that valorise and prejudice our need for learning. And we assume that that will be the principal motivation of people who have experienced harm. And of course, it is an important motivation often. And we hear that all the time. I just don't want this to happen to somebody else. But it seems like we've taken on board that bit, but we haven't necessarily taken on board a lot of the other needs that people have. So I think that, you know, simply kind of dignifying, and that's the word that I've learned from harmed patients, is, you know, these events and people's experiences at their events need to be dignified and valued in their own right, not just because they present a learning opportunity to organisation. From what you've described and from what I know of your work, it had a profound effect on the people who, you know, and that's come out in your evaluation, hasn't it? It had a profound effect on lots of people who took part in the process. But what did you find most challenging about that work? What most stayed with you?
Well, that's a hard question. I was thinking, when you were talking then, I was just thinking about how what we're actually trying to encourage people to do is unlearn. So, you know, it's this whole idea in safety about decluttering our systems. Well, actually, we need to declutter our practices and unlearn how we've been institutionalized into thinking how we should respond to people. Because as clinicians, we come to this space because we want to heal people. We want to alleviate suffering. We want to provide support, and we want to be connected with people in a dignifying therapeutic relationship. And really, what we've been talking about today is exactly that. That is what we should be doing in the aftermath of harm as well. So we have to declutter our thinking about risk mitigation and instead lean into the discomfort of that. Being restorative or embedding these processes, so we actually now have them in our national policy here in New Zealand, which was a outcome of the MESH project, was that because we found that a restorative response meets people's procedural and psychological needs in ways that embedded responses were found to compound harm. We have actually now got them in our national adverse events policy, as also in our current Mental Health Act that's just being updated, our health and disability standards. But people are wondering, well, how do I do this in practice? How do I not, you know, traumatize people or make things worse by trying to meet with people when they're in their moment of the most distress and despair? But actually, I think we should be asking a different question, which is, you know, how do I approach this in a way that someone would expect when they were stepping into a healthcare institution, in a way that, as you say, centers dignity and care and respect for identity and equity and cultural safety and all those things that we know are important. In terms of what I found hardest about being in the MESH process, and certainly in all of the work that I do with harm patients and families and harm clinicians, is that sometimes it can feel quite overwhelming to know where to start. And I have learned to trust in the process that I have come to love and study and try and understand better. The other thing is that being seeped in other people's suffering is very challenging. And bearing witness to suffering is known to actually be quite traumatizing, vicariously traumatizing and morally distressing for people. So I have learned ways in which to mitigate that. So as people that work in this space, we should be finding ways to create space for ourselves. So there needs to be clinical supervision. There needs to be peer support. There needs to be opportunities to not always be working on the worst cases. And also, we need to be really thinking hard about which cases that we should be stepping into ourselves as well. And I know it's something we've talked about before, because then that extends into research. So I've certainly found it extremely challenging to sit through all those stories of harm and distress whilst at the same time feeling that it's not my harm and distress, it's, you know, theirs, and that I'm not there to study it. But to say that it doesn't affect you in on an emotional level would just not be true.
Yeah, and you've made some fantastic points there. And I think, you know, it's both an honour and a privilege, and also emotionally challenging to hear and try and act on people's experiences. And I think it certainly changed me as a researcher. And I think that people who start to think in this way, it can feel quite overwhelming. But actually, that's what clinicians do all the time. You know, it's that boundary between delivering care, feeling compassion for people, but being able to walk away at the end of the day and care for oneself and all of that sort of stuff. So I think I would encourage our listeners who are thinking about starting to work in this way to think, you know, that life is very rich, and we need to experience all of it, don't we? And I think in a sense, limiting harm to learning, or limiting harm to what we can do just to make sure it doesn't happen again, is both incredibly invalidating for the people who've been harmed, but also doesn't really help us connect with the things that we're doing to people, and the things, the way that the system works, sometimes to create harm. And so, final question to you then is, what are your hopes for the future of restorative responses?
I think my hope for the future would be that we're really thinking about how we balance healing, learning, and improvement, and in the aftermath of harm, but also how do we create the space for well-being and relationships to be prioritized in our everyday work, so that we're mitigating the risk of harm in relationships by focusing on how we connect together and how we recognize those, the important role of relationship plays in well-being, so that when things go wrong, we've already got that relational slack, that relational kind of capacity within the system that makes it easier for us to bounce back from conflict. Because conflict actually plays a really important role, is very protective in terms of preventing or mitigating rather harm. We need conflict. We have very robust conversations with other clinicians, patients and families around trying to, you know, have patient-centered care. And then when things do go wrong, on that very kind of pointy, gnarly end of the triangle, that we can actually balance healing, learning, and improvement. And I think that's really going to take a very radical, different way of looking at how we respond to these events overall. And recognizing that there are things that people need in terms of their emotional, social, kind of spiritual well-being. And then there are also things that we need to know and understand that can improve our systems, and that those two processes can work together and move away from each other and still come to a point at the end where there is either resolution, or the hope is that there will also be restoration of people's dignity and of their trust, and potentially even the opportunity for reconciliation.
And I think that's probably the word that we need to focus on. It's restoration, isn't it? And that means doing something which is centred on the needs of the people involved. And that's pretty much where I think we can leave it for today. It just remains for me to say thank you so much, Jo, for joining us, especially so late. And it's always a privilege to talk to you. And it's certainly a privilege to interview you for this podcast. And I hope that this has been of interest to our listeners. And so we will say goodbye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you have enjoyed this episode, and do check out the others in this 6-part series. The series is funded by the National Institute for Health and Care Research and brought to you by the Patient Safety Research Collaboration in Yorkshire and Humber. The views expressed by the guests are their own and do not represent those of the NIHR or the Department of Health and Social Care.